think one of the best pieces of advice I got was actually early on when I started that transition from developer to designer. And it was a senior designer who said it. And of course, when he said it, I didn't appreciate it. And now that I'm years in, I'm like, oh, I totes get that now, because wow, it didn't resonate when I first started. But he asked me, he said, Rachel, when you were a developer, who told you what to do? Other developers, right? And I was like, yeah. He's like, now that you're in design, anyone with eyeballs will tell you what to do.
Hello, friends. My name is Kirill, and you're listening to my UX Career Podcast. On this podcast, I'm sharing my personal thoughts on how to start a career path in UX, how to grow your skills and become a better designer. Also, I have conversations with other designers and design leaders trying to show that there are many different perspectives and opinions on the key questions about UX career. So if you're a UX designer or considering becoming one, this podcast will get you better prepared for finding a job in UX. Opinions expressed on this podcast are my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of my current or previous employers. And don't forget, this is just one human's point of view. Also, if you're interested in UX career insights and some key learnings from my experience, you can sign up for my newsletter about UX career. Go to newsletter.uxcareer.co. Now, back to the episode. Today I'm talking to Rachel Krebs, who is currently working at a fine company as a senior UX designer. We talk about how Rachel got into the UX field and how her education in chemistry and business helped her gain skills that made her a better designer. We also talk about her love for complexity, working with internal tools and a ton of constraints, and all the challenges that come out of this, and why it's important to be authentic to a true self, and how you should be tailoring your resume, portfolio, and interview conversations to match what you're looking for and what kind of job you want. We also talk about portfolio designs that pisses her off and some of those interesting tips and advice on the projects and how you could add more case studies. And we also talk about the common mistakes during the whiteboarding exercises and the whole ethical concern about using them as a method to interview designers, design candidates. And a lot more. And this conversation is also quite entertaining. And Rachel definitely brings her personality to our chat. Hope you enjoy this episode. Hey, Rachel. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm pretty dope. I was looking forward to this conversation, and I'm really happy that you could find time to come to my podcast and share your opinions and your perspective on some of the questions that job seekers in UX have.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, appreciate your time. Okay, so let's start with the just high-level introduction, and again, as much as you can share, on what you do today and where do you work and what really kind of the scope of ownership there.
Sure. Okay, so like you said, Rachel, I currently work at a very large tech company. I'm going to keep things kind of vague. For reasons. And I've been working there for a few years. Before that, I worked at a large bank and insurance company for 7 years. So I know that's sometimes a little surprising that someone would stay at a company that long, but they kept me interested for that many years. I am currently a senior UX designer. I work on internal systems at the moment, which is a passion of mine. Anything else? Have I missed any of your other questions?
Okay, you mentioned about the company, which is undisclosed, the previous path. I think that's good. So you mentioned that you like internal tools, right? Like your passion. Can you maybe elaborate on why you like internal tools? And yeah, what really makes you excited about working on internal tools versus maybe something customer-facing and like more, I guess, leaner experiences? Because internal tools are very complex. They have really complicated workflows, a gazillion of different stakeholders, processes that you need to consider, different debt from technology or like business, like bureaucracy, many other layers. So what really makes you excited about working in this particular area?
Yeah, well, actually, pretty much everything you just said is why I like it, ironically enough. So, I mean, I've done plenty of user-facing things, customer-facing things, I got started out in design on a team that owned a customer service experience. And so I think part of it is obviously that was what I first got into. So that's how I learned design. I don't have a degree in design. My degrees are in business and chemistry. I kind of fell into design as a profession. And by fell in, I demanded I do it just because my little sister did it. And it seems like something I could do. True story.
Easy.
Yeah. So I think there's obviously some of that bias, but to be perfectly frank, I love really complicated technical problems where, you know, anywhere you look, there's something interesting and complicated. And especially with internal tooling, you tend to have more compliance and legal. And like you said, there are stakeholders. And can I be smart enough and clever enough to make an argument that will resonate with multiple stakeholders? Can I make something better? Oftentimes that when it comes to internal tooling, companies don't tend to throw a lot of money behind internal tools. And so it really forces you to be really smart about what you're going to do, because you're not going to get, you know, the big budgets for like huge names that we would be familiar with in the consumer world, the Alexas, the Google Assistants, whatever, tons of money being thrown around. Internally, they're very lean and they're like, let's just get the best that you can do. And so it really forces you to have to focus on what is the most important thing? How can I focus on that and do it best? And then honestly, one of the last things is a total ego boost. When you work on internal tooling, you have your users right in front of you. You're working on consumer-facing things. It can be really difficult sometimes to find those consumers, get them in, can be expensive. It's like a whole rigmarole. When you're doing stuff for your coworkers, it's usually really easy to say, hey, I'd like to sit down and you tell me how much you hate this tool. And so you get so inspired by your own coworkers and you can get that information and feedback quickly. And if you don't suck at your job, because we've all done that plenty of times, but when you don't suck, sometimes they thank you to your face, which is a rarity when you're doing external facing things. So for all those reasons, I just love internal facing tooling.
Oh, that resonates with me on so many levels. And I agree. It reminds me of the, I think it was a quote from one of the geniuses in the design world that you need to have a lot of constraints to come up with a great design. So like just without any constraints, without like too many limitations, it feels like sometimes it feels that it's harder to come up with a creative and really innovative solution. So it's kind of, and maybe it's just psychological, but like for me, I sometimes get stuck if I don't have constraints. Mm-hmm. And working on internal tools, which I'm also a part of that world, and I also enjoy that much more than consumer-facing products. And obviously, consumer-facing products may get also complicated, may get more, I guess, at least look like and function more closer to the internal tools. Think of like Asana or some kind of this mm-hmm. more complicated products that are designed as an internal tool. Maybe they are targeted internal tools problem space, but they're more consumerized, like as mm-hmm. as a kind of even like design trend, right? That we have been seeing in the last few years. But yeah, I agree. Like I love all those constraints and challenges, and it just like makes me, it feels like it's just the next level of challenge for me as a designer. And consumer kind of, at least the standard, what we think of consumer-like products, they don't force me strain my muscles as much, so to say, mm-hmm. which kind of, yeah, it's a bit less satisfying as when you can get to the outcome. On the other hand, though, like I remember working at a fintech before, and I actually didn't enjoy. I was quite frustrated with the legal and compliance layer of constraints that they would bring to the table. This was so, yeah, very challenging for me to kind of to find the solution there. But yeah, challenges are challenges. You also mentioned that you stayed, that you were surprised that you would want to stay for 7 years at one place, right? Mm-hmm. In one of your previous companies.
Yeah.
What did they do right to make you stay there for such a long time? Because especially with the trend I'm seeing across many of my connections is that, and even like outside of the UX industry, that it's first of all easier to change companies. Mm-hmm. As a specialist, as an expert in your field, it's become much more common as well. And from my personal experience, I think there is a huge list of benefits of changing companies more regularly, from going into different problem space to obviously financial gains. Usually, you would be growing your salary faster, your compensation faster, to really expanding your network and getting to know more people and learn from more people. And it's really, for me, it's like usually every time you change a job or a company, it's just a huge boost to your growth as a professional and as a human as well. Because the more diverse the team is and like the diversity of the experiences they bring to the table, the more I can learn from them. So it's a bit selfish as well. But yeah, so what I'm trying to say, like I've seen the trend, I'm seeing the trend that more and more people just kind of jump around, mm-hmm. and like stay in a company for less than a year, and I even personally know some people who do that quite often. So I wonder what that company did right. Back to my original question, to keep you motivated and happy and stay there for such a long time.
Yeah, great question. Honestly, the funny part is they did a lot wrong at first, and that actually led to one of the reasons why I stayed. I was originally hired as a developer, and when I came on, I was supposed to be on a team that was focused on social media platforms, but another college hire had been hired a month before me, and so that team I was supposed to go on had a greater need at the time, and so he actually took my position. And so I was kind of without a team for about 8 months. And I did almost nothing. I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have a project. I had nothing going on. And I almost left that company and changed professions. I had been hired, like I said, as a developer. That was from my business degree. I had this chemistry degree and I was like, well, this blows. Maybe I'll just go do chemistry next. So I actually was interviewing and talking to people about chemistry. And to be perfectly frank, it a lot of luck of my entire career. I can just say all of this happened and then this giant hunk of luck was always involved. I happened to talk to the right person right before I thought about leaving the company. And it escalated to like a VP or something that some random kid who just came out of college was going to leave the company. But all of that to say is, they immediately came and talked to me and said, like, I didn't know this was happening. How can we help? And then from there, I was open and honest saying, hey, this isn't working for me. I'd like to try design. Caveat, I didn't know what that meant. Didn't even know what Photoshop looked like. I'd seen my little sister do stuff like that. And I thought, why the hell not? And the way that they treated that is they immediately gave me over to a senior designer and basically said, make her a designer. So I apprenticed essentially. And because of that experience that they were willing to admit that they had messed up, and they even came and interviewed me, how do we avoid this in the future? They made it right. You know, that was what kept me the first time. And then whenever I had a manager who just really clicked with me on that, I love bouncing around. I tell every manager, if I am not learning, I am leaving. Period. Like that's what gets me up in the morning as I'm learning something new and different every day. You know, I heard you say, you know, if I had moved, I could have more money. I could learn more things and things of that nature. 100% true. But they knew that if they just kept me learning, they would keep me engaged. And so he always loaned me out to all the different areas of the company. And so it was a banking and insurance company. So we have all these insurances, all these banking accounts. We had financial. I mean, it was huge company. And so it was easy for me to bounce and bounce and bounce and bounce and learn and learn and learn and learn. And then I almost left after that because I had become the lead of their internal channel, owned it top to bottom, soup to nuts. And I was about to leave the company because I was like, okay, I kind of learned all of this. And they had an innovation space and they said, hey, because I had been loaned out to everyone, they all knew my name. And they're like, oh my God, you're thinking about leaving. And I'm like, yes. And they're like, holy crap, before you jump, try our innovation space. And I was like, okay. So then I got to learn blockchain and conversational design and AR, VR. And so that kept me for another 2 years because I was like, ah, I get to learn all these new things.
Yeah.
And then finally, at the end of that 7 years, I was like, I think I've hit it. I think I've hit the end. And so all of that to say is I kept learning, and that company that I was originally with was always willing to help me be in work the way that I wanted to be and in work. And so that's what they did right for me. They never made me feel like a cog. They always cared. And I had great leaders who always knew what I wanted, and I was always open and honest with them about what I wanted. And again, I got really freaking lucky in the right places with the right people who took an interest in me.
Very interesting. I think the topic of being lucky is almost like another series for the podcast. I think you can go really deep into this, but let's move on. We have a bunch of other questions to tackle, but very interesting. And I agree, the learning is definitely probably my biggest priority when I think about staying, when I make a decision about staying or leaving. I guess the secondary, or maybe like the tie for the first place, is the management and like my direct supervisor, which it, at least from my point of view, impacts the employee experience maybe even the most. And what you said, like that you were lucky to have like a supportive manager at that stage, and that they helped you learn and grow and like loaned you out to all of the other teams. I think this was actually one of the lucky moments. But again, like, was it luck? Or was it, who knows? Okay. Let's talk about, we talked about your path and the previous roles. That's interesting. Let's talk about the things you wish you knew when starting your career. And it kind of relates to what you already mentioned, that you started in the chemistry world and like your education chemistry, right? And the business. And then you just watched or observed your sister who was doing something similar, I assume also UX. Mm-hmm. And you thought like, why not? And like, it sounds easy and interesting and challenging for me enough. And I can do it. And I think that's a good approach to tackle any problem or any goal that you may have. And just like roll your sleeves and just kind of dive into this. So thinking in retrospect, I'm sure that you've learned a lot, especially without having the formal education, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. What kind of findings, like takeaways, key takeaways from all this experience that you've gathered over the years? What would really help you at the beginning?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think there were so many different things. So many different things. First, what the Photoshop icon looked like, that'd have been nice to know before I had to do something with it. That was a funny Google. But I think one of the best pieces of advice I got was actually early on when I started that transition from developer to designer. And it was a senior designer who said it. And of course, when he said it, I didn't appreciate it. And now that I'm years in, I'm like, oh, I totes get that now, because wow, it didn't resonate when I first started. But he asked me, he said, Rachel, when you were a developer, who told you what to do? Other developers, right? And I was like, yeah. He's like, now that you're in design, anyone with eyeballs will tell you what to do. And I didn't get it at first, but he's 100% right. I did not understand, having come from more specialized fields like chemistry, where it's like, yeah, only other chemists are going to make fun of you for being an idiot. Like, most other people are going to be like, I don't even know what you did, nor do I care. But when it comes to design, and I started telling people this, that not everyone can be a designer, but everyone is affected by it. And as a result, everyone has opinions. And so having to really understand, and this is where I was so blessed to have that business degree, where a lot of business is networking and making friends and shaking hands and the whole rigmarole, how much that actually helped me in my UX design, because I can't do anything without those relationships. Because yes, anyone with eyes is going to judge what you do. And so your ability to be effective is really based off of you primarily. Your personality, your ability to influence, your ability to make those business cases. So I think that was one thing. I think the other thing that I would have been nice to know was that starting out and not, like you said, I had no idea what design was. I just saw my sister do it and thought, screw it. If she can, I can. Because I'm that arrogant. She has a degree that I was like, well, of course I can. Such a jerk. But in any case, was understanding that the background I had actually worked. So I didn't do the stereotypical things or what I thought was stereotypical design. Growing up, I'm not that kid who's sketching. I'm not like real arty. I'm more into the math, the sciences, and the sports. And so it's like, I don't know why I said I could do this. I'm not that stereotypical, more graphic design or UI design. Mm-hmm. But what I did have from the chemistry degree was a deep understanding of strategic thinking and outcomes. So when you're in chemistry, they teach you how to ask questions, how to question assumptions, how to see 10 steps ahead. Because if you mix these reagents, you have to know that in 10 steps, it's going to explode. And so you have to be able to think through all of that. And so a lot of when I first came in, there's the imposter syndrome. It's not even, for me, it wasn't even necessarily imposter syndrome. It was truly, you don't know what you're doing. And so you have to make it up as you go. And you'll be like, I don't know colors. I don't know fonts. I don't know typography. I don't know any of these words they're using. But as it got better, the guy who was basically, I was his apprentice. I remember the first time he asked me for critique, and it was the most amazing thing because I remember I started giving him critique, and I was like, dude, why are you? I literally stopped halfway through and said, why are you asking me? I'm the junior. You've been in the game for years. Why are you asking me? And he stopped and he said, because you're the most logical person I know. So if I show you my design and there's a logic flaw, you will find it. And that changed the game for me. That's when I realized I didn't have to be that visual designer. I didn't have to fall in love with typography. It was the fact that I understood logic and systems was enough to be the type of UX designer that I am. Obviously, I'm a particular type. I'm not, like I said, please don't come to me and ask for fonts as a dyslexic. I'm like, is it legible? Great. Let's just do that. But I think that would have been nice to know that, what I had already learned in other professions, I could apply readily and easily to the UX field to be successful.
That's actually a very, I love this point. It's an amazing point. And I think this would be relevant for so many people who are starting out today, who are changing careers. And I've heard so many times from especially non-directly related professions, like careers. And I would argue, before I just heard what you said, that chemistry is not directly related to UX design, but you kind of changed my mind here, converted me. So I think this would be super valuable because there is an assumption that in most cases, unless it's either marketing or maybe development or business, or maybe architecture and psychology. So there's a kind of common things that are at least have lots of overlap between those professions and UX design. That if it's not one of these close related professions, then you're kind of lost your time and you kind of have nothing to present and you're starting from zero, which I always disagree. And I think your example and how you also communicate and explained it, I think it shows a really good, it's a good case for proving my point. And even some people, when they switch careers from basic customer service in restaurants, I'm my belief, and I've also had experience working in customer service in retail. My belief that the skills that you build there, especially working with people and really asking the right questions and understanding what they really need instead of what they are saying they need, and really kind of navigating through this Q&A to guide them through basically to the right solution, and a bunch of other things about like networking and real communication with humans. This is like such a widespread and very critical skill for UX designer. So, and lots of people who change careers, they don't really, they kind of somehow immediately forget or dismiss what they've learned. Mm-hmm. And I always struggle with that. Like, I'm kind of like, you need to analyze what exactly you were doing there. And there is, you will be surprised how much overlap and really cross professional skills that you can apply that you learned there and practice there, especially if they come from if they have at least some real work experience in the work setting, and they really build this soft skill muscles that are totally applicable in the UX design world. And you're completely right about that. Everyone with eyes or ears, for example, if you work on like a voice or like some other mediums, mm-hmm. right, would be the judge of what you design. And I mean, we're humans. We're like always really want to share our opinions and have our own thoughts on experiences, even if we're not qualified as kind of experts in design. And yeah, that kind of resonated with me as well. It's like it's my daily life.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, I think this is. I just wanted to say that this is an excellent point. I love it. And yeah, you kind of I learned about the chemistry background now a bit more. And yeah, how you describe it definitely resonates with the, I guess, more a designer who is more focused on like the UX piece and not just kind of the visual design, but really the core underlying, so to say, the architecture of the digital experiences world, logic, questioning, really kind of seeing through the whole journey, analyzing all the steps and like kind of the different paths, how you can go and like what will happen. So I think it's super critical for, as you say, like you have a specialized role. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very good comment. I love it. Thinking from the point of view of the entry-level or junior UX designers today, mm-hmm. the competition is huge. And with all these boot camps and like other additional kind of quicker programs, Google certificates and everything, more and more people join this field, right? And mm-hmm. I'm all for it. But this creates a much fiercer competition for job seekers because they have to compete with gazillions of other similar looking profiles and portfolios and resumes and just really hard to stand out. Mm-hmm. So, and you as a person who has so much experience and who also interviewed so many people from the company point of view, right? From the interviewer mm-hmm. side. I wonder what advice would you give to junior and entry-level folks? How can they really stand out from the crowd?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think the first thing that I would say isn't necessarily even how to stand out from the crowd. I think the first thing is to be comfortable with who you are. So like I said, you know, I show up as myself everywhere I go. And some people love that and some people hate it. And so the first thing I would want to tell people is, look, if you are trying to change who you are to match some company for whatever reason, you've already lost. Because when you do show up as your authentic self, they're going to be surprised and you might be surprised in how they react to you. So first, my first thing off the bat is don't try to change yourself to fit some version of whatever this company is. If you guys don't fit, you don't fit. It doesn't make you bad or you wrong. You just don't fit. There's a billion companies. Find another. And if you're so inclined and you can't find one, make your own damn company and then you can fit all the ways that you want to fit. So that off the top. Now, when it comes to, you know, standing out and presenting your best self, now I think that's a good question. First off, don't lie. Let's just put that out there. Don't freaking lie about what you've done because jerk interviewers like me are going to push on that and really, really go for you. But so, you know, standing out, don't lie. But you can be clear about what you have done and what you haven't done. And I think a lot of it is I want to know what kind of leadership opportunities have you had or have you sought out? Because I don't want to hire somebody that I'm going to have to babysit because I already have a job. I'm good at it some days and I'm not good at it other days. And I really don't want an extra job. So I want to teach you. I want to help you learn. I want someone who is humble enough to learn. But I want to know that they can lead things, that they know how to communicate. Your resume should tell a story. It doesn't have to be the best story ever told, but tell me a story that is coherent within your resume itself. I worked here. I led these things. I changed this process. You know, things of that nature are really helpful. I think, you know, I tend to hire for UX design. We tend to hire for the things that we are already in. And so I want to know that you have actually talked to a user. So if you can tell me, hey, I did a user interview one time, I'm like, oh, thank God, you've met the basics. You'd be surprised how many people have not. There was a manager once that I knew who was interviewing for a position, and I was on the interview, and this individual had worked 25 years. In the design profession. And then when I asked, well, how many users, when the last time you talked to a user, and what'd you learn? They had never once talked directly to a user. That was shocking. And so if you give me a resume that shows that you have talked to users before, that you understand some of our most basic skills, like I know what a customer journey map is, I know what a user persona or a jobs to be done is, like, I want to know the basic stuff, like, for love of God, get the basics in there. So those are all things. Again, I mentioned it earlier, I'm a dyslexic. So if you're going to come at me with like different colors and hard to read fonts, I will not look at your resume. If you're going for like a UI job that like you're into typography and like that's how you do, great. I'm going to put your resume down, but the person who likes it might love it. So that's just another thing to be aware of. Like, I'm not going to be super stoked on it. I'm like, not my thing, but someone else might. So obviously tailor your resume to the job that you want. I think that's another thing that I tend to tell people, you know, if what you want to do is UX, highlight your UX skills. If what you want is like UI, then highlight your UI skills and meet my basic expectations. I think those are probably, and of course this fell out of favor a while ago, and thank God that trend that was out there was like, I'm like some progress bar amount of whatever skill. And I'm like, I'll tell you, one person did that, said that they understood HTML. I asked them about it in their interview, and boy, that I would not have had that bar filled as well. They ended up looking real wrong when I asked them some questions, because again, you know, my background's in development, so I like I said, I'm a jerk interviewer who's like, is this the pain? Is this the pain? And just point on. So that's what I'd probably say. I don't know if any of that was helpful, but that's my point of view.
That's good. What about the portfolio? And a bit more kind of tactical on the structure that you would expect, especially with your UX lens. What I've seen, there are two camps of people who kind of the readers or like the audience for the case studies. And they have actually opposite opinions on like what should be the structure. So I wonder, what's your opinion on that? The format, the number of projects, and maybe mistakes and other tips that you could give to the audience.
Yeah. So like I said, I am a busy lady. So anything you do that makes me work harder, we're not off to a good start. Maybe there are other people who have time to scrutinize. I do not. So first off, nothing pisses me off more than when you just have a set of images with no context, because then you are relying on me, the busy asshole on the other half of the screen, to click on every single one and read what you did and what was the project. I don't have time. So what I'd rather you do is, you know, give me two or three. I'll probably more than two. If you give me two, I'll be a little sad. Give me at least three. Give me at least three. Three things. And I want to know, just tell me before I click on it what I'm looking at. Is it, this is the name of the project, this is what I did on it, like UX design or UI design, whatever. And like the name of it, so I'm not clicking on it and going, oh, apparently you made, I don't know, like some flower pot. I don't care. I thought this was, you made some like water sensing device and that was not correct. So help me out ahead of time so I know who you are and what you think, just to even get into the darn thing. The next thing that I'm going to start doing is, once I get into the case study, is I'm going to quickly scan for what role you played. So if you can call that out for me, that's super helpful. And then I want to know, what was the problem you were trying to solve? Who are your users? I want to see something UX-y. Give me like a flow. Give me like a something. Give me something. I don't know. Give me something I can quickly look at and go, oh, that's what they were doing. And then I want to see some kind of high fidelity, something or other. So be like, can you actually design something? But that's kind of the way it is. And yeah, I've seen people who will write a novel. God bless them for having that amount of time. I don't have time to read it. I will read highlighted things. And then move on. So I think that's kind of stuff. And you don't have to go into depth on every damn thing. I don't care. I really don't. I want to know that you know how to break down a problem. You know how to come up with design goals based on that problem, talk to a human being, and then tested the darn thing, build it and like tested it is usually the best. And then obviously give me the results. If you have them, tell me. I just want to know. Because if you just shout it into a void, like, cool. Also, when did you get feedback on that? So I think those are kind of my big deals that I want. And from that, it's just basic stuff. So I'm a huge fan of accessibility. If you come at me with inaccessible colors, if you're doing that kind of crap, like basic stuff, I guarantee you, if you come at me with an inaccessible site and there is some light gray on some fucking white, I'm going to call you out in the interview. 100%. I'm going to ask you, do you understand how to design for users of different needs and abilities? So just know that you probably won't always run into someone like me. Is that like, I will cut you for this. But just FYI. Oh, and then of course, please make sure your information architecture makes sense. I don't, like, don't put me, it's just basic. A portfolio becomes a basic website design. I am judging the structure of your portfolio even more so than your actual case study. There was one woman that I looked at a portfolio for, and it was linear forward only. I could never go backwards. Oh, I was, suffice it to say, I demurred on her and sent her to other teams. So just basic kind of stuff. Your portfolio is a design problem. I'm your user. Go talk to people. What do jerks like me want to know? So those are mine.
Yeah, this is very entertaining, first of all, as usual. So appreciate adding the flavor here and your personality, and super valuable as well. And the whole challenge about like different expectations that I mentioned before we started recording is really that's your particular expectations, right? And then you're saying that like it's basics for you, but for people who are just starting out, they hear different advice from different people in the industry and they're getting confused about like what really they should do. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of, that's the reason why I'm trying to bring more kind of to illustrate the diversity of the opinions on the interviewing side as well. And yeah, I love it. One more question I had on the portfolio. So thinking mm-hmm. from the, thinking of a situation when you are just graduated from a bootcamp, let's go with this, which is okay. Like a big number of new entrants in the market today, right? They go maybe through like 6 months program or 4 months, and I think the length of the programs decrease with every next week. It's like every next week you see a new program popping up that now you can become a designer and get a job within like 1 week or something. I'm exaggerating, but the trend is going that way. Mm-hmm. So usually after they graduate, they would have like one standard case study and not even half, but some kind of showing one of the methods that they learned during the course. Mm-hmm. So this creates a gazillion of similar looking almost templatized portfolios. Mm-hmm. That's really hard to, again, back to my initial question, stand out from other graduates of the same cohort or other bootcamps or other types of programs. So, and considering that it's almost like it's really a chicken and egg situation, right? So you're expected to have, first of all, more projects, and you're expected to have some real world, like real life work projects, mm-hmm. and in order to get a job, you need to have this in portfolio, and in order to add them to the portfolio, you need to have a job, or at least a job. Mm-hmm. So lots of folks today are stuck in this particular situation when they're struggling to find opportunities or maybe some ideas on how they can add more, I guess, more proof to their portfolios that they can do the job. So the next interviewer, the next career manager can really get a better sense comparing to this like one case study that they get from the program. So if you were to start doing, like you graduated a bootcamp today, or just kind of starting out, right? So you have one portfolio project, which is hypothetical. What would you do really? What kind of, what steps would you take to add more projects to your particular portfolio?
Gosh, what would I do? I don't know. Run to chemistry. No, probably. You know, here's the thing. At least for me, when I'm interviewing people for entry-level positions, I'm more interested, can you think? Do you know a design process and can you think? I mean, I don't know if I'm unique in that way, but that's what I'm looking for. So when it comes to trying to pad it out, I'm okay with you doing a hypothetical as long as you, did you actually ask a user? Did you at least do that? So if you're trying to add an extra project, think about, I mean, the entire world is designed. Everything you're living right now was designed, either intentionally or unintentionally. You experience problems every damn day. You see them every damn day. Pick one of those things, go do it. The boot camp's going to tell you, it's going to teach you how to do the process. You saw a problem, you write down what the damn problem is, you go talk to some people to figure out what the damn problem is, then you start ideating and how would you solve said problem. So just do that. You can do that with just so many different things. I mean, if you really had the wherewithal, there are so many ways you can volunteer with different groups. They're like, hey, I just need someone to help make this website better. I mean, if you have kids, you might have them in some sports and their kids' website blows. You can say, hey, I'm just looking to try and get some experience. Do you mind if I try to do this? I mean, there are so many opportunities. They're not easy. They're not handed to you. I'm not going to sit here and act like it's just so easy. It's not. It's really not. It takes time and it takes effort. So first I would use the boot camp to make sure that this is really the profession you want to be in. And if not, then cut and run, because it's going to be more of the same. That's kind of like, pick something you're passionate about. Because if I'm doing an interview and I'm talking to someone and they are passionate and excited, you can't not somewhat be excited with them. So if you have one that you're like, look, I did this on my own and I was really excited about it and I tested it and I talked to people and I did the whole process, that's going to just, that will help you. So if someone's coming in and I'm doing an interview with them and they're kind of like uninterested and they're like, well, I did this one thing one time. I'm like, cool. You're so uninterested that I'm uninterested in you being here. So if you have something that like you're excited about, let that excitement come through. I mean, I'm an excitable person, so I really like being around people with a lot of energy. And honestly, when you're done a full day of interviews with people and someone can come in like a little jolt of electricity, that's helpful. So, I mean, that's kind of what I would do, is look in your life, look for things that aren't working, look for things that impact people around you, go through that process that the boot camp will have taught you, take those pictures of you talking to users through the whole thing, whatever. And then look for ways to volunteer in simple ways. There are so many people who don't have time, effort, money, wherewithal to do stuff. And you can show up and be like, hey, maybe I can help you.
What are your thoughts on... So one of the... I guess from all my conversations and observation about the different interview processes that companies use for UX designer, one of the key steps in the process after the initial conversations and like portfolio reviews and everything is some kind of practical hands-on design exercise. Sometimes it could be take-home exercise. Sometimes it could be whiteboarding real-time exercise. And there are different flavors to this. And this topic and some ethical concerns about the way some companies implement this stage in the interview process, mm-hmm. and what their expectation is of the time commitment of the free labor or like ideas generation and so on, there are many, many red flags that could be there. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this way, because both options, and let's talk about like the two different ones, like the design take home exercise, which gives you more time, usually several days, or at least a few days. It's really up to you to kind of decide if you want to spend like 24/7 working on this or some limited number of hours, even though sometimes there is a guideline, or a real time before COVID, obviously, in the office, like whiteboarding session, which frankly I'm a big fan of. But both options have pros and cons. And there are different flavors. So maybe the design exercise could be a paid exercise. Mm-hmm. So some employers, some companies offer, I guess, somewhat fair fee for just you going through the exercise, regardless of the outcome, which I already respect. Some companies could use either of those options to solicit ideas for free. Like, mm-hmm. that's related to their business, and like it's kind of also an ethical question. Where was going with this? Okay, yeah. So, what are your thoughts on either of those or both? And yeah, maybe any tips and any advice or mistakes that candidates that you've seen and you maybe facilitated those sessions make?
Yeah, great. First off, let me say this. I am a lazy person. And so if someone was like, hey, you get to take this home and work on it, I'd be like, I'm done here. Like, it's not, this relationship ends today. So first off, again, I said it earlier, pick the company that matches you, period. So if a company asked me that, I'd be like, we're not having this conversation because that does not match my lifestyle. But... you know, I think, yes, they are problematic fundamentally. And it takes a company who has good processes. I was going to say ethical, but that may not be, it might just be legal. But in any case, whatever constraint they have either imposed on them or that they have imposed themselves, they are definitely things that can be problematic. And so, again, I would say if you're going into an interview and someone asks you to do a whiteboard session and it's clearly spec work for them, you have to make a decision if that's a company you want to work for, that they wouldn't even begin to exploit people like that. One, two. Yeah, I do whiteboard sessions. And, you know, I think they're really interesting. I am never judging you on what your actual design at the end is. I don't really care. I prefer, first off, like I said, lazy. I'm never going to give you stuff to take home. What a nightmare. But like a 1 hour, help me think how, I want to see how you think. I'm more in favor of that. Again, if it's spec work, we have to figure out, do I really want to work here that they would do this? And that's up to you. I can't make that choice for you. Maybe you're like, yeah, I'm totally cool with that. Then you know what? Do you? It's your life, your company, whatever. But when I'm looking at whiteboard sessions, I am looking for one fundamental thing. Can you ask questions? That's what I want to know. Can you ask a question? Because in you know, when you get a job, people are going to come up to you and they're going to ask you to do junk. And the first thing I tell all of my interns and all of my entry-level designer is never say yes, always ask questions. Meaning, don't just say yes to stuff because you don't know what they thought. I don't know what you thought. There's all these assumptions. Never say yes, always ask questions. And then after you ask all those questions, then maybe you can say, okay, fine, I'll do this. You almost never have the ability to say no, so don't run around like, I have a no stick. Like, no, you don't. But you shouldn't just say yes because you can. In any case, so when it comes to whiteboard sessions, the biggest mistakes, the ones that my eyes will glaze, is if you just jump in and start solving something for me because you said yes and didn't ask questions. So I want to know, ask me the questions, because guess what? Whiteboard sessions, they're intentionally not going to give you all the information because they want to see what you're going to do. And so your job is to help try to uncover that. And that's what I want you to do if you're my colleague, that I can send you to a meeting with some crazy product person who's going to ask for the world. I'm comfortable because I know you're going to ask a whole bunch of questions to slow their roll and make sure that what they're asking for is logical to literally anyone. So that's mistake number one. Just for the love of God, ask questions. Two, please don't try to impress me. Like, you have 1 hour. I'm not, don't. Like, be yourself. I used to work in an area with a particular technology that a lot of people know. It's a big name. And they knew that. And so in their whiteboard session, they tried to impress me by suggesting a solution using the technology that I was on the team for. Guess what? You're not gonna impress me. Like, I work in that area. I work with that technology every day. I'm more likely to go, well, that won't work. That's not how that works. I mean, if it had been a logical answer, then make it a logical answer. That's fine. But if you're trying to do it just because that person works in that area and I want to impress them, like, maybe think about why you're doing it. So again, don't try to impress. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. The thing I tell everybody at the beginning of an interview is, guess what? The interview is about you. You're the only expert in planet Earth on you. So you should be comfortable knowing that you are the expert. The one thing is with the whiteboard session, I want to see how you think, to see if you can work through a problem. So be you, but be the questioning, humble, curious you. And go from there. So yeah, don't do that take home shit. That's messed up, man. I'm a hard pass. I'll never get a job again now that I say that. Someone's gonna be like, mm-mm, she said she wouldn't, she's out. Be like, oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, it's almost like a pre-screening mechanism between candidates and companies. It's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, the only challenge though, not the only, but one of the challenges is that how do you really, and I like the comment that you made initially that choose the company that kind of aligned with what you want to do and how you want to do it. I think this is key to being happy at work and really do your best job and grow in the way that you want to grow. The issue is though, is that it's practically impossible to find that company. So, I mean, it's possible, but it's such a frustrating and slow and manual process. And this is kind of another project that I'm working on, that I'm trying to address this. I kind of scratch my own itch because I've been through this so many times. When you go through the whole interview process, and it's even outside of the, either it's the use design exercise or whiteboarding, it's like overall the matching between the next team, the next company that you want to join or at least consider joining, and mm-hmm. your priorities at this stage of your life and career and your preferences and desires. And it's such a complicated puzzle that you need to get together, right? So you need to get some questions from different layers, from different roles in the company to really have at least theoretical understanding of what you will experience if you decide to join. And usually, at least from my experience, in order for me to go and collect all these answers, you would have to go through almost the whole interview process. Mm-hmm. And only then, in most cases, I would kind of understand that that's actually not my cup of tea, and I would bail. And this is such a huge time waste for the candidates, for the companies, and it was very frustrating. Like, I do not look forward to the next experience like this. So this is to address the comment about like find the right company. The secondary though is that obviously you're sharing your opinion and your thoughts, right? And I agree that design exercises are often a questionable method to understand, to get the answers to the questions about the candidate that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. Whiteboarding is an alternative, which is more time conscious because design exercises will take more time, even regardless if they pay for it or not, if it's ethical questions that they ask you or problems that they give you. But sometimes people will not have physical time to do this, right? So, and like companies who have this step in the process, they just ignore or kind of do not consider this. What if they have a family with a bunch of other obligations? What if they have parents they need to take care of? What if they have three other jobs that they have to juggle? And it's really, I think it definitely excludes a significant segment of the audience, of the potential candidates of the pool, who just won't be able to have this time. And even outside of your lazy comment, that's another big audience that they're excluding. But,
me, the few, the proud.
But yeah, you're kind of, you're a bit more, I guess, on the privileged side that you can choose. Mm-hmm. Because thinking from the, again, the lens of the entry-level junior folks, first of all, they don't have experience and they don't really, they haven't tried different environments, different cultures, different team dynamics and vibes to really understand what they're looking for and what really resonates with them, right? So mm-hmm. they go, the advice I usually give is really at the beginning of your career, I would prioritize the diversity of different experiences, mm-hmm. different problem spaces, different structures and teams and everything, just to really think carefully about your feelings after that and really understand what you love and what you do not really enjoy as much, right? So, and then with every next data point that you collect after the next experience, the next team, the next product you work on, you would, your calibration of your own priorities would get better and better with every next step. And only then you would be able to, okay, that definitely, if the team is asking for design exercise, that's not for me, when you have a choice, right? But for the entry level, I'm a bit more forgiving of those, I guess, principles that I maybe impose for myself. Mm-hmm. Because again, like going back to my comment about trying as many things as possible to really understand if it really makes sense for you would be my priority. So yeah, I understand your point of view, but for the entry level, I would disagree here. I mean, it's definitely the person's choice if they can do this. I would not advise against that.
Sure. Oh no, I mean, yeah, it makes sense. My thing is, look, if you get the heebie-jeebies from the jump, don't assume them heebie-jeebies is going away just because you get in the dough. Put it that way. But, oh yeah, please, I got loaned out everywhere. I 100% agree. Say yes more often than no, especially early on. I'm still saying yes to stuff that I'm like, wow, I hate that. I'll never do that again.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then, like with every next yes and every next, yeah, I think you won't be able to learn as much about yourself as a designer and as a person if you always say no, because you just, like, you won't be able to experience that. But if you say yes, it's still additional learning, either towards validating or confirming what you already know about yourself, that you mm-hmm. actually love that direction, or uncovering something new and really understand that actually that's not the path I want to go. Yeah, I think it's constant learning even about yourself, right? And you're changing priorities too, because depending on your career stage, or maybe, I don't know, even technological environment, and then maybe something new comes up and you kind of actually haven't experienced this yet, or your life situation, like priorities change, and that's totally fine. I guess the tricky part is to really be regularly reevaluating what you care about and what you want to do next, not to get stuck on the previous information that's maybe already outdated, but really mm-hmm. constantly be in touch with yourself and your priorities to make sure that the next choice you make is aligned with where you want to go. I think that's definitely, that's been the case for me. It's quite fluid and yeah.
Oh yeah. Please, we're all works in progress, y'all. And exactly. If you don't think you are, you probably have more work to do than others.
Exactly. Awesome. Okay, so I actually want to question a bit on this whiteboarding choice and the whiteboarding exercise. And I understand that this is like the least of the evils from that kind of exercises, that kind of processes or steps in the interview process versus a design exercise was what's more time consuming, and let's put aside the ethical question, the ethical side of it. But from the whiteboarding exercise, first of all, the concerns that I've heard, and I'm just curious to hear how these resonate with you or not, and if you think there is a better way to get the answers you're looking for as an interviewer without using whiteboarding as well as obviously design exercises, like take-home ones. So the first concern is, like, you rarely, you probably never go through any design process within 1 hour in real life. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot of, like, a lot more conversations outside of just the questions of the session. It takes more people in this relationship, in this partnership. It takes, first of all, deeper thinking when you, even when you want to formulate the questions, because you need to understand the many different things. And with every next thing you understand, chances are you'll get more and more questions. Mm-hmm. So, and I understand it's like the whiteboard is a bit more, it's not really condensed version, but sort of like a condensed MVP version of this whole process. So I understand that that's the purpose of the whiteboarding exercise. The secondary challenge, though, which is probably even more critical, more important, I think, is that thinking about the diversity and inclusion, right? Mm-hmm. And increasing the, I guess, making your hiring experience more inclusive. There are people who would be amazing professionals, amazing designers on your team with really great skills and deep thinking and problem solving, but who are just not tuned or not in favor of this quick on-the-spot thinking, right? But mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that they cannot really do the job. So for these folks, from what I've heard, like this whiteboarding exercise is a potential risk, especially at the time perspective mm-hmm. And the limited time on this. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, is it, do you still think it's ethical choice for a company who prioritizes inclusive hiring practices or who wants to go this route? And if there is potentially maybe a more inclusive approach that could replace whiteboarding and obviously take home design exercises.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I couldn't agree more that the design exercise and the whiteboarding is specifically tailored to a certain type of person, period. And I think that is exclusionary. To answer your question directly, is there a better way? I would say, yeah, there is. Do I know what it is? I sure as hell don't. But I think right now the industry is lazy. And I'm part of the laziness. I'll raise my hand. I'm part of the lazy. Already admitted it earlier. That because that has been what we have traditionally done to try to see, do you ask questions? Do you know how to think structured? Blah, 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 blah. That we've kept it. I think it's the stuff that we bitch about our partners with when they say, it's always been designed this way. And of course, we're willing to yell at them for it and be like, well, you need to be better. And then it's, you know, look inclusively, like, or look at our own selves in the mirror and be like, guys, I think we're doing something that needs to be better. And we're just kind of like, I mean, I say that generally. Obviously, there are other people and companies who I'm sure have already figured out what a different and better way to do this. So yeah, is there a better solution? God, yeah. Humans made the solution and the problem. There's going to be a better way to do this, like every fucking time. I just don't know what it is. And what I would, I mean, ideally you would have a great number of people helping design these processes. What do we really like scrutinize what is actually required to be successful and allow for that serendipity and that, oh wow, I didn't know this little chemist could grow up to someday be a senior UX designer. Like who the hell knew? I didn't. I had a senior designer tell me she was so pissed when I became a designer. She was like, who's this kid? She's not going to be able to help me at all. And then I ended up, I could. So I'm one of those people who has benefited by not having that process. So it would be hypocritical of me to say, oh, well, they should do it because everyone does. I don't think that's true. I'm an advocate of an apprenticeship type of model. That's what I grew up around. That's where it gave me all the time to explore and all those kind of things. I think that's a great model. You know, are people willing to put in the money for it? Companies? Probably not. But should they? Maybe. I think there are different ideas, different models that can be done. This is just the lazy, efficient way to do it now. It doesn't make it the right way. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the best way. But I would really invite people to solve that problem for all those who get cut out of the system because of our own industry's laziness.
Yeah, I agree. And I've seen how some, at least very, very few companies try to address this this issue is by just removing the step and focusing more on getting the answers that they're trying to get with this exercise at earlier stages during the conversations and portfolio presentations and just questions and really kind of digging deeper into if they can ask questions, basically one of the goals of this exercise, and what kind of questions, and if they really can work through the problem. So, and I think it's a pretty good, I mean, it's a reasonable solution, and at least a better step in the better direction to not exclude folks who would not really shine at those during those exercises, because data and kind of the performance during these steps, this has been used heavily in the decision making if they want to hire this person or not, which definitely reduces the diversity of the workforce and the team. So it's kind of perpetrating the problem. And I as a designer, obviously, I've thought a lot about a possible solution to this problem, and that would solve it for everyone, like for the whole industry. And frankly, I haven't found one. And I think the core problem here is that there are just too many parties involved, too many humans that are like representing those companies and job seekers as well. And there's just like lack of standards. Like everybody does their own thing. It's like very fragmented. And if, for example, you can change it in a few companies, the vast majority of the market will unlikely to follow because they just do their own thing. It's just the lack of any standardization. And it's tricky. It's tricky. It's like, it reminds me of my, one of the quotes that I remember from one of the VCs about how they make decision about if they want to invest in a startup or not. And one of the questions that I remembered clearly, and I use it, I think, with every next project that I try to tackle, is they ask a question: if the problem is a technology problem or a human problem. And if it's a human problem, those should be dealt with by therapists. And this kind of reminds me of that. Yeah, so it's, I mean, obviously it's a bold statement, but I think if you think about the underlying causes of these behaviors, of these decisions, it's really kind of humans and their lack of understanding of the impacts. It's lack of real understanding of the ripple effects of on their company and the diversity of their employees and the workforce. So it's really like, in order to solve this, you would have to educate every single person who's involved in this, which is unreasonable, at least for resources that I have. I decided to take a passive approach and observe how the industry and the hiring process evolves in the companies, and see if somebody can solve this would benefit the whole industry, because it's definitely, it's not good. It's not good. I don't support this.
Yeah. Our industry is rife for some innovation.
Yeah. And there are so many different problems with this hiring process and like interviews and all the relationship between the prospects, job seekers, even like up until they become employees, and the companies. There's so many problems. It's quite painful and frustrating as well, especially for folks who are not in the same position as you are, or more experienced folks who basically have a lineup of companies who want to hire them. So for those entry level and junior folks, it's definitely, I empathize with their situation, because it's not getting easier. It's not getting easier. But I think, like, as a summary of what you mentioned several times during the conversation, and then we'll wrap up. I think the key takeaway that I completely agree with is that you need to know who you are. You need to understand yourself and not misrepresent your personality and what you know. And this will eventually attract the right companies and detract the companies that will not, actually you will not be happy at. Even though there is, like another said, there is a benefit of experiencing the less enjoyable environments and experiences, because frankly, I learned probably even more from those experiences about not just myself, but like how things should be done in a team, as a hiring manager, as a leader, right? So it's definitely a person learns from both sides of this kind of the both types of the experiences. So there is value to that as well. But in the long term, definitely knowing yourself and really being able to pre-screen companies will help you go deeper into really tailoring your resume, your portfolio, your presentations to that particular company and their business problems and their audience and their like their hiring managers, versus trying to spray and pray and tackle the whole market and then like get lost in the sea of the same bland and generic looking profiles. So yeah, it's almost like, yeah, I love the quote that you said that I heard before too. You are, how do you say it? You are the expert of yourself. Oh,
yeah. An interview is all about you, and there's only one expert on planet Earth, and that's you.
Yeah. I think it's totally, 100% true. Awesome. I think that's we've covered so many questions, and I truly enjoyed this conversation, Rachel. Thank you. Thank you for your time and for sharing your wits and humor and obviously wisdom and experience from your career. If folks would want to find you online, maybe if you're open to this, and ask a question or maybe just connect and have a chat about something related to UX world, where can they find you?
Honestly, probably the best place to look me up is probably LinkedIn. Rachel Krebs. Chilling on LinkedIn, hit me up.
Do you ever chill there, or is just a gazillion of unread messages there?
I look at it from time to time, y'all. I'm paying attention. God. But sounds I might be good. Slow. Sounds I've already good. Said it like six times. Lazy.
Yeah. Keep in mind, Rachel is lazy, and make Fire sure make sure that the message that you send her, if you do, is very crisp, concise, and to the point.
That's right. Don't you put in no funky fonts. I won't be able to read it.
Sounds good. Awesome. Thanks again, Rachel.
Yep, thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you want to see more episodes and support this podcast, the best thing you can do is leave a review on iTunes and share with your friends and colleagues. If you have specific questions you would want me to answer, you can submit them on the UX Career website. Go to uxcareer.co/questions. Goodbye, friends.